Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in life, our minds, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll bring you the latest research about tech time not to be blamed for teens' mental health problems. A study of 400 teens finds little evidence linking excessive smartphone use and mental health outcomes. Wow, that's news. Then I will speak to Dr. David Burns. I'm so excited. He's an adjunct clinical professor emeritus at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science and the author of best-selling book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy. I always learn so much from him, and I know that all of my audience, everyone who's ever listened to him, they want more and more and more of him. He's amazing. So I'm excited to have him on the show again. You can call us on the studio line if you like, 951-922-3532 to talk to Dr. David Burns or me. Be sure to listen to my podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and share it with your friends and give your remarks. Call me or send me an email and about the topics that you would like me to talk about or bring guests. We'll be right back with the tip of the week.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Welcome back. This is the tip of the week. I've been noticing how easy it is to be real and what a grand price we have to pay when we're withholding or pretending to be someone we're not. So what is being real? I certainly don't mean to vomit out all that shows up in your thoughts and emotions. Being real is to uphold what your beliefs, principles, and values are with your expressions and actions, right? So being on integrity with it is to uphold the beliefs and principles with your expressions and actions. When you withhold your ideas, when you withhold them, the ideas, opinions, rights, and desires, you end up resentful, small, held back, stuck, and ultimately depressed. Expressing who you are effectively frees you up to enjoy life. Your free essence and upholding all that you believe creates confidence that becomes attractive, actually, to others. When you're confident about your values, they are sustainable and maintainable. Others will know you as those values and principles. Guess what? When you're fake, withholding, or your values are not for the betterment of yourself and others, then you will create lots of drama and chaos. This will not be attractive to most people. May be attractive to drama-seeking people who will maintain a chaotic life with you. And I don't know if that's something you really want. So respect yourself and others. Be real. Life becomes effortless when you're real. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with the latest research about teens.
Join Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Tech time, not to blame for teens' mental health problems. The latest study. The study tracked young adolescents on their smartphones to test whether more time spent using digital technology was linked to worse mental health outcomes. The researchers from University of California, Irvine, University of North Carolina, and Pennsylvania State, blah, 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 university published in the journal Clinical Psychological Science. They found little evidence of longitudinal or daily linkage between digital technology use and adolescent mental health. They say, the researchers say, it may be time for adults to stop arguing over whether smartphones and social media are good or bad for teens' mental health and start figuring out ways to best support them in both their offline and online lives. Contrary to common belief that smartphones and social media are damaging adolescents' mental health, the researchers did see much support for the idea that time spent on phones and online is associated with increased risk for mental health problems. So the study surveyed more than 2,000 youth and then intensively tracked a subsample of nearly 400 teens on their smartphones multiple times a day for 2 weeks. Adolescents in the study were between 10 and 15 years old and represented the economically and racially diverse population of youth attending North Carolina public schools. The researchers collected reports of mental health symptoms from the adolescents 3 times a day, and they also reported on their daily technology usage each night. They asked whether youth who engaged more with digital technologies were more likely to experience later mental health symptoms and whether days that adolescents spend more time using digital technology for a wide range of purposes were also days when mental health problems were more common. In both cases, increased digital technology use was not related to worse mental health. When associations were observed, they were small and in the opposite direction that would be expected given all of the recent concerns about digital technology damaging adolescents' mental health. For instance, teens who reported sending more text messages over the study period actually reported feeling better, less depressed, than teens who were less frequent texters. Wow, go figure. I think that there's been a lot of conversation about teens depression and social media and the use of 10, and I guess this is a different one that just showed up this week. So I really think that it isn't just about the time that they are on. It's also that we're probably not offering anything exciting for them, or they're not creating anything exciting for themselves offline. So many of the exciting concepts, whether it's their relationship, conversations with each other, communications, music, videos, studying, information, they all and all come from this device. So that has become the concept of all. Anything that they want to experience, they go to it. So it's not that they're only utilizing for one purpose. It is a multi-purpose concept. But not having it and having a real relationship face-to-face and being with someone and interacting with someone and doing other types of activities which uses their motor skills is probably lessened. So it's how to, for the parents, how to balance that versus thinking that that just having it being off balance is going to create mess. I think anything that is off balance is going to create some sort of a mess, but not necessarily that it creates mental illness or less of a mental health. Now, let me tell you that I am so excited to have Dr. David Burns with us. He's an adjunct clinical professor emeritus at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. His best-selling book, Feeling Good, The New Mood Therapy, has sold more than 5 million copies worldwide and is the book most frequently recommended for depressed individuals by American and Canadian health professionals. Many published research studies have indicated that 65% of individuals with moderate to severe depression who are given a copy of his book improve dramatically within 4 weeks with no other treatment. His website, feelinggood.com, contains free resources for therapists as well as the general public, including his popular weekly Feeling Good podcast with more than 1 million downloads. He has won many awards for his research and teaching, including the prestigious 2018 and 2019 Irma Bland Award for Teaching from the American Psychiatric Association and A.E. Bennett Award for the Basic Research from the Society of Biological Psychiatry. His latest book, Feeling Great, is nearing completion and will be published in 2020. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with Dr. David Burns.
Hello, I'm Dr. Fujian, and I have great news for you. I'm offering a special time-limited offer to anyone who's interested in online therapy or coaching sessions. I've developed the awareness integration model, which allows in only 12 weeks to raise your self-esteem and confidence and let go of your thoughts and emotions that produce depression and anxiety for you. So call today to schedule your online session and save $600. Call me today at 818-648-2140. That's 818-648-2140. Or go to www.fujian.com.
Dr. Fujian Zain is a psychotherapist, a marriage and family therapist, and a life coach with more than 27 years of experience. She is the author of the Awareness Integration Model, which has been researched and published in numerous international journals. Dr. Fujian has offices in Beverly Hills, Irvine, and Woodland Hills, California, and also consults online and by telephone. Make an appointment with her today by calling 818-648-2140 or go online to www.fujian.com. That's www.fujian.com. Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm so excited to have Dr. David Burns with us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's always a lot of fun to work with you, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. I always learn so much from you, and it's just, it's amazing. And I know everyone who listens to us and watches the video, YouTube video, they always give me comments about wanting you back more and more and more. So definitely, it's great that you accept graciously to be at our in my show. So I know that you have, as we were speaking before, talking about cognitive distortions and what are some of the cognitive distortions that really holds people and puts them in a position that What I say is like they bring themselves down. It's more like it's not necessarily that life is bringing them down. It's some of the way that people look at things constantly brings them down.
Yeah, it's a very ancient idea. It's mind-blowing. It's really the path to enlightenment, but it's so simple that, you know, people don't get it. And it's just the idea that we think we're upset because of what's happening to us. People feel that I'm not loved enough, I'm not successful enough. I can't tell you how many people, including mental health professionals in my training group, have approached me just in the last month or two telling me I'm not good enough and feeling tremendous angst and distress, anxiety and self-doubt. And the idea that goes back to Epictetus and the Buddha 500 years before Epictetus was, 2,000 years ago, is that we're disturbed not by the events of our life, but by the messages we give ourselves. It's our thoughts and not what's happening to you. And this is so basic that people, it just goes in one ear and out the other, but it's potentially liberating and life-changing. And then the second huge idea is that when you're depressed, when you're anxious, when you're angry, when you're frustrated, you're telling yourself things that just aren't true. You're fooling yourself. Depression and anxiety and anger as well have been called the world's oldest cons because you're believing things that seem true, but they're not true. And then the last idea is the liberating one. When you change the way you think, you can change the way you feel. And it doesn't take long. People have asked me, how long does it take to recover from severe depression or anxiety? And I would say, well, generally not more than 15 seconds or 30 seconds. But it's working up to that 15 or 30 seconds that sometimes takes a little bit of artwork and a little bit of time. But the change happens in a whoosh. The moment you stop believing things that are upsetting, in that very instant, you'll get better. A simple example is, let's say you were living, 50 million years ago, and you hear a sound, and you have the thought, my gosh, that's a tiger. You're going to feel terrified. The thought will instantly create negative emotions. And then if you look and you say, oh, that's just my wife, that was a tiger, you see that the thought was wrong. You stop believing the thought. In that very instant, your emotions will change. And it's the same today with depression and anxiety, except the thoughts we give ourselves are distorted in subtle ways. And so it's really easy to fool yourself for months, years, even decades.
It's always been interesting for me to look at the reason that we do self-destructive acts. For example, whether it's the thought process that becomes self-destructive, or through the thought process we go into a self-destructive act, such as eating things we know we shouldn't, smoking, doing behaviors that we know is going to be inappropriate for us or doesn't work for us. But, in some sense, we keep hearing that the body adjusts itself constantly, that the body is an organism that supposedly is trying to survive consistently. And so therefore, it wouldn't want to destroy itself. It wants to do things so that it actually survives and moves forward. And then within that context, then the question shows up, then what does our brain try to do when it's constantly trying to get us into trouble or lie to us or defeat us or destroy us?
Well, if we can take a specific example, I can give you a tremendous answer. I try not to answer things on an abstract level because it leads to kind of like BSing type of thing, and people don't really grasp anything useful. But if you could talk about some specific
habit
that people have, or addiction or something like that.
Well, based on what you were just saying, that our brain was lies to us, and then it gives us thought processes that are just not true. They're not true, but they keep coming back. And so starting from that, and then yes, extending it then to what we do to shut it up, which is addiction, or, you know, then we go through that. For example, that everything that creates anxiety for us, in a sense, or depression, as you called it, our brain goes into lying to us.
Right. And what is the question exactly?
If the body and the mind are an organism that supposedly is set up to work itself through survival, then what is the mechanism that keeps lying to us? What is it that our body also does, our brain and body does the opposite, which is going toward destruction?
Well, I don't know the causes of things, and scientists don't know the causes of things yet. We could talk about the 10 distortions that you were mentioning
yes.
earlier, and talk about the ways we fool ourselves. The new team, CBT, has some new perspectives on why we get addicted to these things that are so painful for us, that are labeled as self-destructive or brain diseases or mental disorders. And we've developed a pretty radically new and different way of looking at the suffering that human beings have without using that type of language. But maybe we should just start with the fundamentals and say, what are the ways that we fool ourselves, the messages? What are these 10 distortions that can cause so much incredible pain?
That's great. Let's start with that.
Well, the first one, and I may do a series of 10 podcasts on the 10 distortions pretty soon, too, because they're so fundamental. But the first one is, and I'm sure you're very familiar with them, too, the all-or-nothing thinking, black-and-white thinking. You tell yourself, if I'm not a complete success, I'm a total failure. And you look at things in black or white. And most of us, you know, are never all one way or all the other. The universe isn't all black and white. I look at my office here. Well, it doesn't look too bad from the camera angle, but I give you another camera angle, and it's kind of disorganized, and you know, it's not like a fantastically beautifully organized office, but it's not a zero, it's not 100, it's somewhere in between. It works pretty well for me, but sometimes we beat up on ourselves terribly if we're not 100%. Like I was working with a medical doctor who was studying for her board examination, and she was trying to diet, and she was going on this very strict diet, and then the third evening of her diet, and she was trying to study and very nervous and worried, am I going to pass this licensure exam? And after dinner, she decided to just have a spoonful of vanilla ice cream from her freezer, which tasted just delicious. And then she says, oh my gosh, I've ruined my diet completely. I've blown it. And then she felt so guilty, she ate an entire, nearly a gallon of ice cream to kind of comfort herself from the guilt of I've blown my diet completely. But then you can look at, from an evolutionary point of view, why do we do all or nothing thinking? And maybe it can kind of help us with our performance and set very high standards. And so our brain gets rewarded too, because our perfectionism sometimes drives us to tremendous levels of success as well. But that's a common one, and I used to do this all the time myself, beat up on myself. If I was helping 9 patients and I got stuck with the 10th, I would be beating up on myself, and I'm not good enough, and creating a lot of mental anguish, for myself. But getting out of this pattern means the death of the ego, the death mm-hmm. of the self, where you're willing to lower your standards, so you don't always have to try to be so perfect. And I found that lowering my standards really helped me, and I started doing a lot better, and I started
True.
Relaxing, and patients liked me better. Now I've lowered my standards all the way to zero, and so everything looks good to me. But it's hard, because for years I wouldn't let go of that perfectionism. I kept telling myself, I'm going to help every patient, I'm not going to lower my standards, and and we get kind of stubborn about it, and that can address a little bit the question, the great question you asked earlier about, from an evolutionary perspective, why do we do these things? Well, because they have positive aspects as well as, you know, biting us when we fail.
So somehow the machinery works up to a point, and then if you use it, overuse it, then it does its own damage in some sense. So if we use the standards in a way that it operates, that gives us a path to move forward and excel, then it's working. But if we get caught into the standard, then it becomes a point of misery.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the pursuit of excellence and wanting to do a good job, wanting to do a great job, wanting to do a fantastic job. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what Edison wanted to do. That's what Einstein wanted to do. That's what Bill Gates, you know, wanted to do, and go for it. But it's only when you can't stand failure, when you spend a lot of energy hurting yourself, beating up on yourself, feeling guilty, feeling ashamed. I screw up all the time, even in my teaching. Now, I had the summer intensive this summer. It was the best one ever. There's actually two standing ovations. It's never happened before, and it was because I treated everyone with warmth and tried to be very, very kind not ever put anyone down and try to make everyone feel.
I've really watched you grow to this part of you throughout the years, because I've watched you.
Yeah.
I've been a therapist for 30 years, so I've kind of followed you for all these years. And I have really seen the progression of this type of love and empathy that you present wherever you are, and honoring and respecting.
Yeah, but I have to forgive myself, because I screw up and fail all the time in my teaching. I'll say something sharp, and a week ago Tuesday, one of my students really seemed to start screaming at me at the Tuesday training group, and it was humiliating, and, you know, it was shocking to me. But I make mistakes all the time, and the all or nothing thinking is going to, you know, make your life miserable. So that's the first of the 10 thinking errors. And the second, go
and then
ahead.
Can I ask you, what do you do with yourself when you make a mistake?
Well, if it's a mistake involving someone else, I use the 5 secrets of effective communication, encourage them to express their anger and acknowledge that I've hurt them and said something hurt their feelings, and that it's painful for me, and I have tremendous respect for them, and to tell me all about all the other times I've said something that hurt your feelings or made you angry or upset you. And that's usually allows you to convert a failed relationship into one that's better than ever. Internally, I have to do the same thing, as to say to myself that I've been really blessed, and I'm lucky to have so many wonderful people around me, and they seem to forgive me when I screw up, if I act humble and don't get defensive, and maybe I can be compassionate with myself and forgive myself as well, because I'll always make errors, no matter what. I had a therapist on the hike, and I'll just disguise his identity. Because, you know, as physicians, we make errors that sometimes hurt people. And he's one of the world's top experts in his field. Mm-hmm. And he's a very humble fellow, too. And he comes to all of the Sunday hikes so he can learn how to communicate better with his patients. I just admire him a lot. He's not a psychiatrist. He's a hardcore basic science physician and working in a very advanced area of medicine. But he gave a prescription for one of his patients with a very exotic disease, and didn't realize that she had started drinking again. And the combination of the medicine plus her drinking led to a horrendous side effect. And she's going to have probably surgery because of that, mm-hmm. a young person. And he was just beating up on himself. I should have asked her again, should have warned her about the alcohol. And he was just in tremendous pain. And, of course, his pain shows what a beautiful person he is, what a compassionate physician he is. But then, you know, we worked, and he found a way to really forgive himself and to get back to joy and self-esteem. When I was an intern at Highland Hospital in Oakland, I was so insecure, and I was so happy that my first resident that I worked with had been in Vietnam. He'd been a doctor in Vietnam, so he was pretty advanced already. But the first day, we went on rounds together. They had something called death rounds. And he had made a mistake that killed a patient. Mm-hmm. But he just took it really, really well, learned from it. And he was the best medical doctor I ever worked with. It was such a joy working with him. But as humans, we're going to make mistakes, and it's painful.
So acknowledging the mistake, looking at what it was, and then
learning,
mending with whomever it is that we made the mistake with, or ourselves, and then learning from it and moving on.
Yeah, rather than obsessing and getting all caught up in endless beating up on yourself, because he still has to communicate with his patient and develop that warmth and trust and help her with, you know, her probably anger and fear and anxiety and her guilt and shame as well. But anyway, that's all or nothing thinking. And it's...
So let's go to the second one.
Well, that's overgeneralization. And that's just so huge. It's, I think, maybe the cause of all depression. I've been very excited and interested in this distortion, especially in the past year or two, because what it is, you take an error that you've made, and then you generalize to yourself as if you had a self. So instead of I made a mistake with this patient, or potential mistake, it really wasn't even a mistake in any rigorous way. But instead of saying, I made a mistake here, you say, I'm a bad doctor, something like that. I've been working with a gentleman who had decades of abuse, and he came to me and asked me, could something like the new team therapy we've developed at Stanford help someone as severe as him? And I'm not in private practice anymore, but I treat people all the time. And he couldn't even afford to fly out here for a day to do an intensive. So I said, well, I'll treat you for free. Just, you know, my heart went out to him. But what he does is to tell himself, you know, he's not making a lot of money. He had a business he started, and he was doing great with it. And then things changed for one reason or another. Google changed its strategies on websites, and now his company is, you know, not making much money. His wife brings in the money for the family, and they're doing okay. But he tells himself, I'm a bad father, I'm a bad husband, I'm a defective person, because I'm not making as much as I think a true man should make. And he's a wonderful fellow, and he's humble, and he's smart, and he's very loving, very, very giving, but he's generalizing to himself. And the solution is called, let's be specific, to instead of saying, like, I'm a bad father, well, like, what time of day was I a bad father? Does my daughter think I'm a bad father? Oh, no, she thinks I'm wonderful. You know, well, then what are we talking about, really? And it doesn't hurt. See, the pain doesn't come from saying, well, the business isn't doing any good anymore, and I think I'm going to have to find a new approach to making money. That will never cause pain of depression or worthlessness or intense anxiety or hopelessness or any of that. It's only when you go from something specific about yourself to thinking, oh, I'm a bad ex, or I'm a bad mother, I'm a bad father, I'm a bad teacher, I'm a bad doctor. That's overgeneralization. And it's similar to all or nothing thinking, except in overgeneralization, you're generalizing to this idea you have a self that becomes defective, and then you generalize to all the future and say, it will always be this way. I'll always be worthless. I'll always be unlovable. And these statements that we tell ourselves, they're just not true, but they feel true. And so we think for all the world, I really am a bad person. And any listeners you have who are listening right now who have felt this, or maybe you felt it, I know I have felt it. It just feels as real as the fact that there's skin on your hand, but it's just not valid. Not what you're telling yourself is not valid. But the pain is so severe, some people kill themselves.
Yes.
Because if it's an all encompassing, then obviously there's no hope for any change or anything else that is different. So
yes.
I could see that a lot of that type of an overgeneralizing becomes part of the game for what's the point? I want to kill myself because that's all of me. What I found with that part of my brain is I try to do this reality check immediately and come out of the minute that I hear this word all, always, never.
Yeah.
The minute I hear those sentences in my own head, I know that I'm lying.
Yeah.
And kind of come back and do some sort of a reality check.
Yeah.
What are your suggestions?
For helping yourself or for helping your patients?
Mm-hmm.
Which? Those are radically different.
Well, let's just use me. So obviously I'm the one who's here.
Okay. Well, what I do is the first thing I do when if I'm working with you as my patient, I would not try to help you. Trying to help is the cause of all therapeutic failure. And most therapists who hear me say that don't even understand what it means, but it just means what it is. If you try to help someone who's upset, they'll get irritated. They'll get angry with you. They'll start fighting you. And when someone's upset and saying, I'm, you know, a loser, or I'm a bad father, I'm whatever, I buy into what they're saying and just say it and provide empathy and support without helping them whatsoever. I want to go with them to the gates of hell. And I would say, tell me what that's like. I have felt that way myself at times. I know that can be one of the worst forms of human suffering. And I feel sad, particularly because I have so much affection for you and so much respect. But tell me what's been going on. Tell me what this is like for you. And then I let the person spill their heart out. And I paraphrase what they're saying. I acknowledge their feelings. I say, wow, it sounds like you're pretty sad and depressed. Is this true? And they say, oh, yeah. And say, I can imagine you're pretty anxious and panicky too. Oh, yeah. And maybe you're feeling guilty and ashamed and inadequate and worthless. Oh, yeah, doc, that's how I'm feeling. I go through all the emotions, say, what are your thoughts? And I'm just getting the information, not trying to change it. And then I say, tell me how I'm doing now on empathy. Do you feel that I understand how you're thinking and how you're feeling? And do you feel that I care about you? Do you feel accepted? What's my grade? Do I have an A, a B, a C, a D? It seems goofy to say that, but they'll tell you every time. And if you're not hitting it out of the park, they'll say, oh, it's a B or a B plus or a C or something like that. And then don't go on until you get an A. I say, well, tell me what I'm missing. And then when I got an A, then I say, what is it you want help with? And they say, oh, well, like I want help with my depression and my worthlessness and I feel horrible. And then I say, well, let's imagine there's a magic button here. And if you press that magic button, it'll disappear in a flash. And you'll walk out of today's session in a state of euphoria. Will you press that button? And everyone says, oh, yeah, I'd press that button. And then I do what's called assessment of resistance. It's TEAM, team, testing, empathy, assessment of resistance, and methods. And then I show all the beautiful things that their suffering shows about them, all the benefits of their depression, their anxiety, their shame, their worthlessness, their loneliness, their humiliation, their frustration. their demoralization, their anger, and we come up with a genuine list. It's not some psychobabble thing, and we will generally come up with 20, 25 mind-blowing things that their suffering shows about them, their high standards, their passion for life, their desire for loving relationships with others, their accountability, their willingness to be realistic, to admit their flaws and errors. The list goes on and on. Their anger, it's maybe your anger shows you're willing to stick up for yourself, and sometimes anger is very healthy. And I really try to sell them on not changing. And I'm very, very good at it. And then at the end I say, why? I say, do we have the tools to change you today? Absolutely. But I can't see any reason why we'd want to change any of this. Look at all the beautiful things that your suffering shows about you. Mm-hmm. And then the patient, and that, it's a paradox because now I have sold them on not changing. And if you do a great job of it, the minute you do that, they will suddenly want to change. And then I come in with methods, and it takes 5-10 minutes, sometimes less, for the person to completely eliminate all of these negative feelings. I skipped a little piece of it. I say, maybe we could do a compromise. Maybe instead of making all your negative feelings go away, we could just lower them to some healthy level, like you're 100% depressed. Look all the beautiful things about you that your depression shows. Maybe we don't want to press that magic button. What would be a healthy amount of depression? Then they'll say, oh, well, 10 would be enough. I'll say, well, sure, I can't sell you on 20. They'll say, no, 10 is plenty. So now, see, I'm fighting for
right.
them.
It's a paradoxical concept.
It's total
paradox. You're fighting for them.
Yeah, right. And then what happens then is the brain becomes so peaceful because this is a deeper form of empathy. And all those circuits that were firing so fast when they were agitated calm down. And then the rational part of their brain, the objective, self-loving part, can quickly take over and knock it out of the park. And usually this whole process, the whole treatment, takes me about 2 hours or an hour and a half, and then the treatment is done. And I don't have patients that go on and on for weeks or months or years for the most part. And I think also when they work with me, they know you've got 2 hours to be cured, so let's get the job done. This isn't going to be an open-ended, endless, you know, talking kind of thing. And I can't always do that, but I can usually do that. And it makes therapy seem like a magical experience. It's just so fantastic to have these new tools.
Beautiful. Let's do the third one also before we end.
Well, I don't know. There's 7 more distortions and they're all fascinating. I'll let you choose. There's mental filtering, discounting the positive. There's should statements, emotional reasoning, labeling, self-blame, mind reading, fortune telling.
Well, since we were talking about self-blaming, can we just take that one?
Yeah, it's
because
huge.
It's kind of in the same construct.
Yeah, it's just huge. I'll disguise this a little bit, let me just say, when I was in Philadelphia, I was working with a wonderful, highly sophisticated psychiatrist, had also done mind-blowing research. She's like a double doctoral person, and she was treating a very high-level, internationally renowned person at the in our hospital. And the patient said that she was the only one that he could communicate with. Because she'd been coming to my training group. So I taught her the 5 secrets of effective communication. And so he had asked for an appointment with her after his discharge. And she didn't have an appointment for about 2 weeks. And so set up an appointment with him in 2 weeks after his discharge from the inpatient unit. And instead of coming to her appointment, he killed himself in a very grotesque way. And it made papers all around the world because he was an internationally beloved person. And then she said, it's my fault because he was so severely suicidal when he was hospitalized. I should have seen him every day after discharge. And it's so easy to beat up on us ourselves in that way. Or it could be a minor, but much less severe problem. Like you say something that hurts a loved one's feelings, but then you can, it's my fault. You can beat up on yourself, and that pain, the guilt, the shame can be unbearable. Yeah. I've had people who felt so ashamed that they wanted to kill themselves, so guilty.
You utilize the same way of just sitting with them within their shame and moving into the empathy and just...
Well, the thing with this particular woman that was so amazing is that her mentors weren't empathizing with her. They were telling her how to cover herself, make sure everything's documented. You know, they were kind of worrying about a lawsuit. And then they tried to cheer her up. And I've seen therapists who try to help people who are angry or upset. And it never is effective. And they tried to tell her, oh, this could happen to anyone. He would have done it anyway. And the more they said things like that, it's like it was patronizing, like talking down to her. Mm-hmm. And all I did on one of the... one of our supervision groups, I just said, wow, you must be feeling so devastated. And I just went through my list of 9 kinds of negative emotions. How sad and depressed are you? And she said, oh, 100%. And how anxious and panicky? Oh, 100%. And how ashamed and guilty. And then we went through all of these. And I said, well, my heart goes out to you. And I can just see how horrible this is for you. And this is really one of the dark side of our profession that's not talked about.
Right.
And even when you're 80 years old, if you're the greatest psychiatrist in the world, this can still happen to you.
Rattle you, yeah.
Yeah, and then that's all she needed. And she said, I'm feeling so much better now. All she needed was somebody to go into her suffering with her, go with her to the gates of hell and acknowledge how awful it was without trying to minimize it, without trying to cheer her up, without trying to help her.
So another thing that I'm hearing from you is that it seems like our psyche and our brain sometimes needs this mirror that as it looks outside, it gives it back what we feel and think. And the more that we get this type of mirroring of I get who you are and I validate who you are, that our brain has its own mechanism to get itself out of all of this. It just needs to be first stated out, heard, seen.
Well, I would say that's partially true, usually not true. It's mm-hmm. sometimes true. In her case, it was true.
Mm-hmm.
But people, usually that warm, empathic mirroring that you so beautifully described that people need that calms the brain does make a more receptive connection with the person. But they still need usually powerful tools to blow away all those self-hateful, self-critical thoughts that are creating the misery. Carl Rogers kind of had this idea that all you need is, you know, a warm, empathic connection, and that's the key to personality change. But he was wrong about that. He was a great pioneer, but his conclusion wasn't correct. But you need great empathy. And therapists who think they have good empathy almost never do. We measure it at every session, with very sensitive scale at the end of every session that'll show the smallest failure. And so you can talk it over with the patient. But empathy is getting to first base. And we still got to get the second and third into the home plate. But without empathy, you can't do anything because the patient will be angry, will be raging at you, shouting at you, not trusting you.
And so the empathy is more of the emotions that gets created in the system, but with empathy and calms down, and then therefore we could come into a centered place. Then now we could see a little bit more ahead of us and move forward. Yeah. Where before receiving that empathy, we're just swirling within our own emotion and trying to find ourselves. The empathy allows that space for us to actually find ourselves, put our foot on the ground, and look at the tools that we need to move forward with.
And be receptive to some tools. And some therapists make the mistake of, when a patient is angry with them, to try to help that patient. And that this will never be effective. You've got to be able to establish that warm, trusting connection first. Then you've got to melt away the patient's resistance, which is intense. And then you can come in with some tools. But sometimes, out of the goodness of our heart, we see someone is suffering. We see how illogical their thoughts are. And we try to do helpful things.
Shake them.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, I love
shake that pain out of them.
Yeah. Stop that, like that Bob Newhart. Stop it. You've seen that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Stop that stuff.
It's been a joy to speak with you. As I say, I always learn, and you ooze empathy. You really have brought this concept of empathy, and the word that keeps coming to me when I've watched you do your seminars and even do your talk about their clients is a lot of higher level of respect in humanity, or their humanness, or who they are. And I think that also creates that concept of empathy. So thank you so much for, again, giving us the time. We came over with about three of them, so we got another seven more to go later shows
Can we give just a quick shout out for Feeling Good, my book, or the free podcast, the Feeling Good podcast?
Yes, people need to go to feelinggood.com. And they find your podcast just on any of the Stitcher or iTunes and Google Play.
Anywhere, but it's good to get them on my website, feelinggood.com, because you got the show notes and links, and you can find mood tests and all kinds of helpful, tons of free stuff.
That's awesome. So go through your feelinggood.com and then listen to the podcast within your... Okay.
Or order, Feeling Good costs, I think, $8 on Amazon, and more than half the people who read it are cured of depression with no other input. So it's not a bad deal for listeners who are hurting.
It is an absolutely amazing book. And Feeling Great is coming up next year, right?
Yes, I just signed the contract today.
Yay! Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks a lot. It's always great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And for all of you who are listening, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. Until next week. Bye-bye.